Okay, kind of, maybe I shouldn't say nice because I missed the others. At the same time, smaller group isn't always bad either, is it? It looks like, I don't know what's wrong with my cord here. A little bit half to three quarter what we are sometimes. So this morning, I'll just say it this way. About 3 weeks ago, I got a brown piece of paper in the mail. Any of you have ever got those things? They got some writing on, but they're mostly brown. Maybe they're not always that color. Y'all don't get those. A jury summons. Yeah, maybe yours came a different color. Mine was brown. And probably it's been on my mind a little bit. I felt a little guilty just printing off this form that we give to all the rest of you and getting Ernie and Jason to sign it. It seems kind of like cheating, actually, because, you know, to be honest with you, somebody's going to have to go sit in that jury room for a couple weeks, likely, take off from work. And so here I say I have a religious reason for not doing this. So I almost wrote along. I just thought maybe I should just write out my own reasons for asking for an exemption and send it. And I thought, well, if office people are like me, they probably have enough to do without reading my ramblings. So is that a kind thing to do? So I just wrote a note on there, and I said, I used the same letter that we use for everyone, but on there I wrote, if you want to discuss this further, I want to understand why better, I am happy to discuss it with you at any time of your choosing. As I understand, I think the judge, at least in Arkansas, the judge has to specifically exempt everyone. It's not something someone else can do. And I haven't heard from him, but what did happen was interesting is I sent that in fairly promptly, and I didn't hear anything for about a week and a half, and that summons was for tomorrow. And I started thinking, you know, what am I going to do if they don't excuse me? This would be kind of interesting. I don't know if Arkansas is exactly the same way. I had a good friend in Kentucky that was a judge, and he said there's no law saying that he has to excuse you for religious exemption. He said technically, if you don't serve according to just the written laws, he said you're in contempt of court and he can stick you in jail. Now he says what would happen in Kentucky anyways, if he did that, his superior, which would be the Supreme Court, he was next to the Supreme Court in Kentucky, they would review the case, and if with a religious reason for it, they would say, well, this isn't worth the hassle of fighting it, and so they would say he was stupid for wasting their resources on something like that, basically. So I don't know that Arkansas is the exact same thing, but I got to thinking, you know, what would happen if I wouldn't be excused? And so I guess you can blame this message or partly on that. It got me thinking just in general. Just a few other thoughts is, what do you call a person who comes from one country? So he comes from one country, let's call that country number one. He goes to lives in country number two, but is paid by country number one to be in number two. What do you call such a person? What's their name or title, job title? Ambassador, okay. Is there any others? There's at least one other one. I'm not sure if you can think of more or not. I came up with two. Emissary, okay, thanks. I would classify that pretty much the same as an ambassador. But there is one other, pretty big different one. Okay, I'm missionaries, maybe so. I often wondered whether they should be, but anyways, I mean, not against helping missionaries, don't take me. A soldier would be, but I was thinking of a spy, technically. A soldier, yes, as in peace, war. I was thinking more just two countries that have relationships, diplomatic, you would have the ambassador, but then most of those spy on each other as well, right? So ambassador, let's see. I better go make sure I even know how to spell this till I'm done here, right? Why is my head like this right now? Get my A's and O's switched around if I don't watch it. So why don't y'all tell me what's the difference between an ambassador and a spy? Just briefly, I mean, don't have to be long or complex.
Ambassadors are in peace, and spies are
Thank you. Very clearly so. Any other ways of saying it? Thank you. Anybody else have something to add or different angle on it? Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you all for that. I looked up just Ambassador Merriam-Webster. It says ambassador is a diplomatic agent accredited to, or I would probably say accepted by, a foreign government or sovereign as the resident representative of his or her own government or sovereign. So now, saying it, that definition didn't help a whole lot in that it used a lot of big words, but basically it's saying that an ambassador is somebody that's in another country to represent the country they came from, if you were going to say it more simply. But that used the word a diplomatic agent, so I got curious just what Merriam's would say on diplomacy. And it says here, the diplomacy, the art and practice of conducting negotiations, skill in handling affairs without arousing or causing hostility. Those are two words I'd like for you to just kind of take with you through this message. So like was already mentioned, I'm just going to, a little different way of saying it, is an ambassador is generally welcomed by the host country, right? They let them build this embassy and they have their office. And so generally it's a big deal when they get a new ambassador. It's a thing for both countries to kind of be big about. Now, a spy, not so much. In fact, that causes a lot of problems, doesn't it? If they catch him, anyways. They hopefully don't catch him. And so thinking about that, what do you think would happen if anyone, let's say I, would try to work for the U.S. government and the Chinese government at one time? You think that'd be very successful? There is some people that do that, and they are called counter spies, and I think they have one of the most stressful lives that you could probably imagine. It's pretty difficult. Yes, you can work together on things, but generally you do not work for two governments at one time. So an ambassador is generally welcomed by the host country, and technically an ambassador is supposed to be, and hopefully is, there for the good of both his host and his home country. But in being there, he's actually expected to be biased, right? If you have an ambassador, if the ambassador from, I don't care, whatever country, Brazil was here this morning, he was giving us a talk on Brazil, we wouldn't have any problem if he was biased towards Brazil, would we? In fact, we would expect him to be biased towards Brazil. If he were not, he would be a rather poor ambassador. If he was more, was trying to run his country down. So he's expected to be biased. Keep that in mind as well. Now, part of the reason I titled this message, Which Country, Which Kingdom? And I hear a lot of people, including myself, at some point in life sometimes, using non-resistance, the doctrine of non-resistance, as a basis of why we don't participate in jury duty or vote and some of such things. And I'm not going to say that non-resistance plays no role, but I actually think it's a rather poor argument. I think there's a better reason. Like I said, because if you go into the doctrine of non-resistance, largely the examples Christ used in teaching non-resistance was generally on the personal level, not necessarily on the national as much. So I'm not saying it doesn't pertain. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that I feel it's a secondary argument at best. So in thinking about that, I feel is stronger is what I would call the two kingdom concept. And that's probably most easily seen in John chapter 18. If you want to turn to a scripture, that'd be a good one. John chapter 18. I'll start reading at verse 33. The two kingdom concept, just as you couldn't be a very successful person and try to work for two governments. That brings up words like spy, counter spy, treason. Really, as a Christian, we have a focus that keeps us from really being effective in serving an earthly government as well. John chapter 18, verse 33, we have Christ in Pilate's judgment hall before Pilate, and Pilate and Christ are talking. And we often probably read over these verses at communion time or some such time, but there's Christ says something about as clearly here as he does anywhere. So verse 33, then Pilate entered into the judgment hall again and called Jesus and said unto him, art thou the king of the Jews? Verse 34, Jesus answered him saying, thou sayest this thing of thyself, or did others tell thee of me? In other words, he's saying, is this something you came up with on your own, or are you listening to the Jews? Verse 35, Pilate answered, am I a Jew? Thine own nation and chief priests have delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done? So Pilate asked a question. Now, Jesus didn't technically directly answer that question, yet he did give an answer. Verse 36, and Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence. Pilate therefore said unto him, art thou a king then? Jesus answered, thou sayest I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. So if I may put this into maybe a little bit more my own words, Christ, just basically 36 and 37, the country and cause for which I have given my life and allegiance is not a country or cause of this world. If mine were an earthly country or cause, then would my disciples fight for my deliverance. But that is not the case. Mine is a spiritual kingdom. You say I am a king, and in this you are correct. I was born for and came to earth to bear witness to the truth. As king of truth, all who sincerely seek truth will hear my voice and become part of the same non-earthly cause and kingdom, spiritual kingdom. So Christ is basically saying, he says, I am a king, but not a king in the way that you're thinking. I'm here with a different focus. I'm here with a different system, if you will. I'm here because of a different country. I'm here because of a different kingdom. And I am a different king. I'm not part of a system that threatens you, Pilate. Not at least physically. You know, at the time of Christ, makes me think of a number of years ago, and I think I've said this maybe a few years ago in a message. Dad-in-law used to deliver some sheds, and the fellow wanted to pay him in cash, so he said he thought he'd get a better deal because he don't have to pay taxes, and dad-in-law just said, well, he said he can pay however he wants to. He said, for him, it doesn't make a difference. And the customer was like, he said, well, I'm sorry. Then dad-in-law just said that, you know, how Christ said, I'll get into that into a bit, how we're supposed to pay our taxes. And so he's going to report it regardless. And the customer was like, well, he said they didn't have the government back then that we have now. And he's right. In fact, I would guess that he probably would have found it more difficult back then than he does now. I guess with all their computer systems, maybe they keep better track of some things. But same time, I think I would rather live under the U.S. form of government than under Caesar. So things were different, that's true. And you know, today, when looking for a good form of government, generally, we don't go back to the Roman system and think, oh, that was the way to do it. You know, the Roman rulers did not have what we call a representative form of government, which means that the people get to vote and choose who is their government. Rather, at least for the countries that they conquered, they did have a Senate, but it was fairly limited, even in Rome itself. But when you came into the countries that they had conquered, it was very much top-down. We bark and you jump. And this brings us to a thought. So we live in a different system. So the New Testament was not written in a time where they were where they had an election in a couple weeks like we do now. The New Testament wasn't written at a time necessarily where they got summons for jury duty because, well, the top guy just said it all. I mean, he didn't need any jury. Skip that. He made it simple. But you know, one thought that often comes across, and in this message I want to be clear, this is more of an apology for myself. When I say apology, my own thought system than that I'm trying to be harsh or critical to those that find themselves on a journey of life. But one thought that often comes across in discussing this with work people or neighbors, that often comes from some of them, is you have to vote or be involved in government to make it better. And I'd like to ask you one question. In the observation of life, if you have had time for this anyway, how does that thought really work out for them? Is the government getting better just because Christians are involving themselves? And that's maybe off the subject. I'm not building a lot of premises on that. That's just a thought. Probably a better question for myself is how can I as one who is supposed to and claim to have given myself wholly to the cause of truth, and I'm living and working for the spiritual kingdom of God and truth, support and work for those whose focus is on an earthly country, we don't call it kingdom today, whose goals, regardless, I want to be clear here, I'm not talking any political affiliation, whose goals, the earthly country's goals, regardless of political affiliation, is on anything but truth. It's a system. It's a way of doing things. And yes, they say they want truth, and I'm not saying that there's no aspects. I appreciate a judicial system that at least maybe makes an effort compared to some in the past for truth. But finally, the truth of the gospel is not what they're after. They're after the truth of man's wisdom. You know, how can a Christian, and again, I'm not meaning to be political by saying this, and that's why I use two names, but how can a Christian whose really heart is for God, seeking after God, has given himself wholly to God, how can they come down and make a choice between a Clinton and a Trump? How do you go about doing that? And I mean that respectfully. Sure, there are policy differences and administrative differences between parties in what I'm going to call representative government. And I find myself as a human being at times liking a certain party's focus above that of maybe the other. Yet, even in this, you know what I've found? Maybe it's different for you, but even in this, I find that my preferences are generally not dictated so much by my love for God as, unfortunately, my liking for what's left in the pocketbook or the amount of regulations that I have to work with. Doesn't that sort of sound pretty selfish as a basis to decide who or what is the best system? Wouldn't this mean that my preference is based on nothing more or less than the selfishness of my own heart? So what basis is that for me to go now and say, oh, I need to vote? Furthermore, who am I as an individual, limited in scope, in understanding, in everything? Who am I to say which government policy and administration would better accomplish God's purpose than what the other would? Can I set myself up? Sure, like I said, I'm going to be honest. There are some policy and administrative differences that if we're making a living, we can't like but help sometimes. I'm not disputing that. At the same time, who am I really to say that a government that's easy, that makes my business more profitable, if you will, that makes it easier, less stressful for me, is actually better for the long-run spiritual well-being of people? There's absolutely no proof for that. And which is God most concerned about? How much money is in my bank account? Or whether people are spiritually seeking after him? You know, consider for a moment again the Roman Empire and the Emperor. You know, that is not a system, like I say, that we would today admire and emulate. We don't necessarily, at least most of us, I don't know that even Mennonites go around looking for a Caesar to... You know, we don't, do we? We're kind of content without a Caesar. Yet, think about this. Wasn't it this very system and the Roman Empire system and this very system and its faults and flaws and weaknesses of destroying innocent human beings that we have to thank, to a degree in a way if you want to, that Christ died? We got into that in Sunday school a little bit, didn't we? So think about that. A horrible system, a system of government that none of us would want to live under. In a way, God, kind of against their will, if you will, used to actually put Christ to death so that I can have salvation today. Yet generally, when I hear us as Anabaptist people that are supposed to be separated from this, by the way, talking about politics, we're mostly talking about what's best for our pocketbook when it really comes down to it. Does that sound at all consistent to you? So again, who is to say what policy or administration would most build the spiritual kingdom that God is seeking to build? I absolutely can't tell you. I can probably tell you which one Joe likes in the flesh, but I cannot tell you which one is going to lead the most people to God. That's way beyond my understanding and scope. Furthermore, as I read the New Testament, nowhere did Christ or those he sent to teach truth promote the thought of becoming part of government as a way or a means to furthering the spiritual kingdom of truth. When Christ told his disciples there in Matthew 28:8, "Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel," he didn't tell them, "Go into all the world and become part of the political system and change the corrupt political system so that we can have something better." He said, "Teaching them and baptizing them." That's a totally different than politics. You know, the world political system, whatever, whether it's representative, whether it's a monarchy, whatever it is all concerned in the end about power and about using force to accomplish its goal. Whereas Christ and the spiritual kingdom is a direct, it's not even direct, because it's completely different in that it's a thing of choice. Whosoever will may come. Does that sound like whosoever will may pay their taxes? How well would that work? It's a totally different system with a totally different focus, with a totally different country and a totally different kingdom. If I can, again, just read those verses again. "The country and cause for which I have given my life and allegiance is not a country or cause of this world. If mine were an earthly country and cause, then would my disciples fight for my deliverance? But that is not the case. Mine is a spiritual kingdom." I'd also like to, if you're still in John chapter 18 there, I've jumped back a little bit now to something else that happened in the garden that also touches on this subject. We go back to verse 10. We have Jesus being arrested and Simon Peter having his sword. And I know you're familiar with that. So Simon Peter sees Jesus getting arrested by this crew. Says they came after him like he were a thief or a robber. So he pulls out the swords and starts whacking. And I don't know, it's been a while, somebody said they're pretty sure he wasn't seeking to cut off an ear. He probably was trying to cut off the head. And I don't know if I thought of that on my own, but that's a good thought. He missed. Anyways, he hit the ear. So Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and smote the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Verse 11, "Then said Jesus unto Peter, Put up thy sword into the sheath. The cup which my Father hath given me, shall I not drink it?" Now that is a really weird response for somebody that's involved in an earthly kingdom to say, "Put up a sword, because I need to suffer what the Father has for me." I don't think if you're involved and focused on an earthly kingdom, you would say that, would you? You'd say, "Get all the swords out. Get busy here." But Jesus said, "Put up the sword. The cup that my Father hath given me, shall I not drink it?" Because again, the focus is on something spiritual. Christ's focus was wholly and completely on doing the Father's will and entrusting rest in that will. So am I saying that I'm a U.S. citizen. I guess probably everybody is here as far as I know. If you're not, you're somewhere. Does that excuse me from any responsibility as a citizen? Do I have a duty to the earthly government I find myself under? And if so, what is my duty? I have three main points on this, and I think it's probably you know them already. But we have Christ's example, and the number one is pay the taxes they levy on you. You know, I don't know how it is for you, but I don't like taxes. That money comes into my account, and it looks pretty comfortable there. And the fact of the matter is, at least in the business side of it, I have to pay taxes once a month. So this is something that's in my mind a bit more than some of you, maybe. Some of the rest of you, if you're not doing sales tax anyway, you probably get by with quarterly. Yeah, that money comes in, and it would just really help your profit margin if you could just jolly well let it there and not have to go to this next step. But in thinking about that, I want to be clear. I don't think there's anything wrong with taking exemptions that the government offers, right? For example, they say that I can take 14 cents per mile if I do church work driving. So there's nothing wrong with taking that off. I want to be clear there. What's funny is that's a whole lot lower than if you're actually working. I've never figured that one out. But so there's nothing wrong with doing. At the same time, I am a bit bothered by a tendency I see in myself, and I think maybe it doesn't stop with me, is the tendency we have to try to do everything we can to find every little way to make sure we don't give a dime more than what we should. Is that really a Christian attitude? Let me read some verses of Christ's example, first of all. Matthew chapter 17, verse 24. You're welcome to listen. If you want to turn to it, that's where it is. Matthew chapter 17, verse 24 through 27. It says, "And when they were come to Capernaum, they that received tribute money," are the ones that collect taxes, "the department of revenue came to Peter and said, 'Doth your master pay tribute?' And he said, 'Yes.' And evidently they didn't, because it says, 'And when he came into the house, Jesus prevented him, Peter, saying, What thinkest thou, Simon? Of whom do the kings of the earth take custom or tribute or taxes? Of their children or of strangers?'" Now, this was a little bit different in that Rome was ruling over that. I understand that. "Peter saith unto him, Of strangers." In other words, Rome taxed the Jews heavier than they taxed Rome. "Jesus saith unto him, Then are the children free. Notwithstanding, lest we should offend them, go thou to the sea, cast an hook, take up the fish that first cometh up. And when thou hast opened his mouth, thou shalt find a piece of money. Take that and give it unto them for me and thee." So Christ paid taxes, you know that? Department of Revenue came after him. He said, "Okay, Peter, I'm not making a profit, but we'll still pay it, okay?" And next one is in Mark chapter 12, verse 14 through 17. Christ, this is more in the department of teaching and command, more than example. Mark chapter 12, verse 14, again, listen, please. "And when they were come, they saith unto him, Master, we know that thou art true." I think this was the Pharisees. Excuse me, Sadducees. "And carest for no man, for thou regardest not the person of men, but teachest the way of God in truth." In other words, they're trying to kind of boast on him and see if they can get him in a trap. Then they ask a really socially hot question for that time. They say, "Is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar or not?" Now, I know a man that I'm not here to question his Christianity at all. He had a glowing testimony for Christ. And he decided, this is probably about 12 years ago, he decided that it's not good to give tribute to Caesar, so to speak. He quit paying his taxes because they didn't use it right. Well, he had the foreseeable outcome. He spent a couple years considering his moves behind bars, I guess you would say. And I've often thought about that. And I'm not, like I said, I'm not trying to here to judge him. But I'm so thankful that Christ made it clear. Because it's true. If you were to look at any government, the U.S. government included, for me to pay taxes would look like sometimes they fund abortion, sometimes they have a war. Where would a Christian find themselves? But Christ made it abundantly clear that we're supposed to. Now listen closely. So they asked this hot button issue, this thing that they thought they really had him this time. Shall we give or shall we not give taxes, tribute? But he, Christ, knowing their hypocrisy, said unto them, "Why tempt ye me? Bring me a penny, that I may see it." Now, I often thought this was interesting. I think he was just making a point. I'm sure he had to know what a penny looked like. "And they brought him a penny, and he saith unto them, Whose image and superscription is on this thing. So their coins must have been somewhat like ours anyhow. And they say unto him, Caesar's. Jesus answering said unto them, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. Pretty clear answer, isn't it? So if the government asks me for my money, it's not dependent on the percentage they ask for. It's dependent on the system that it's part of. Ouch. I sometimes at least could grow my attitudes if nowhere else. So again, think about that. Paying my taxes, not dependent on the use they make of it. Christ is saying it's part of that earthly system. And while you're under that earthly system, you give what they ask. Whatever that is. Romans 13, 6 and 7 touch on that as well. I'm going to read those verses in the next point, so you can just keep that in mind. So the second point of my responsibility as a Christian to the civil government is honor, respect, and obedience to them in the position they have. Why don't you turn to Romans chapter 13, please? Read 7 verses there. Romans chapter 13, verse 1. So now we're thinking of honor, respect, and obedience to them in the position they have. Let every soul be subject unto higher powers, for there is no power but of God. So now God's not saying that there's never power misused, but he's saying finally, there is no power outside of me. I allow it. The powers that be ordained of God, whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that will resist shall receive to themselves damnation. Oops. I don't know. It's been a long time, thankfully. But there was a time in my life when I had a question if I got stopped and I was at a place where I thought I could get away. It would have been just sort of tempting to see if you could try it. That's a terrible thought, isn't it? You know, running away from a police is basically, God says, as bad as running away from me, isn't it? I don't know how else to read that. He goes on and says, for rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt receive praise of the same. For he is a minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is a minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon all them that doeth evil. Now, unfortunately, not all rulers necessarily follow this. This is God's goal for good civil leadership, I would say. There's definitely been times that civil leaders have persecuted, and that's a misuse of their power. But at the same time, think about it. We were driving in yesterday, and a state trooper turned around right in front of us, and Debbie just made this comment. She's kind of surprised how much we see them on some of these roads, and I said, I just thought of it recently because I was way out in the middle of nowhere the other day, and here was one watching the traffic. I said, I do get caught. I've got my problems there. But I said, one thing is, I'm still glad they're there. Have you thought what it would be to live in a state with no police force? With how some people are. And you know what? There was one time I felt misused and abused, but I was still guilty. I thought he upped my speed 10 mile per hour over what I actually was, but to be honest, neither of us was arguing that I was doing faster than I should have been. So even in that case, I have to say I'm still thankful, even for the ones that maybe aren't honest. Because finally, they are there. Probably, I don't know if any of us could have come to church in safety if there wouldn't be some government, some form of control over evil men and their, yeah, whatever. Okay, going on. I think this is verse 6. Wherefore you must needs be subject. He says, now as a Christian, you must obey, not only for wrath, not because you're scared of the fine or being stuck in prison or whatever else, but also for conscience sake. As a Christian, you have a conscience, and you need to obey them because of that. For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers attending continually upon this very thing. I knew that said it, but I hadn't thought of it before. So he's saying that's the very reason there is civil government, is to collect taxes, it looks like. I'd read that. Maybe there's different ways to explain it. But it says they're God's ministers attending continually upon this very thing. I'd say the Department of Revenue does a good job of that. Verse 7, render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. So he's saying, give. What's demanded from an earthly system in an earthly way, where it's not interfering with spiritual, give it. Whether it's taxes, whether it's honor, whether it's custom, give it. First Peter chapter 2, verse 13 through 15, I'll just read this to you. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme, or unto governors as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of them to do well. For so is the will of God, that with well-doing ye may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man. Ah, that's hard for me. Yeah, all right, guys. It's not so bad to wear a safety harness and a hard hat when it's 50 degrees, but when it's 100, that's a whole different level. Whew. And that's just one. Anyway, an area I can keep growing in. Now, that said, I want to say there is a limitation to a Christian's obedience to civil authority. We have two illustrations in Acts almost consecutively. One is Acts chapter 4, verse 17, and the other one in chapter 5, 27. So I'll just read these to you. Limitations to obedience to civil rulers. Just to balance this out. So we have Peter and John after the healing of the lame man. And in Acts chapter 4, verse 17, they're before the council. Actually, they're speaking to the council. The council is speaking to them in 17. But they say this, but that it spread no further among the people, this doctrine, the Christianity, let us straightly threaten them, the apostles, that they speak henceforth to no man in his name. And they called them and commanded them not to speak at all or teach in the name of Jesus. And Peter and John answered and said unto them, whether it be right in the sight of God to hearken unto you more than unto God, judge ye. For we cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard. So in a way he asked a question which was very tactful of Peter, whoever was talking, saying whether it's right in the sight of God to listen to you as civil rulers, in a way at least at that point, more than to God, you all answer that question, but we can't help ourselves. Then in 527, they were rearrested. They were put in prison overnight, and that's when they were released and were back preaching in the temple. And they were arrested again and brought before the council, and it says this, and when they had brought them, they set them before the council and the high priest, and asked them, say, did we not straightly, clearly command you that you should not teach in his name? And behold, ye have filled Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood upon us. Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than man. So there is sometimes conflict. Yes, that would be, for example, joining the military. There is, and I'm going to bring up what I call some friction points here in a minute. But where there is conflict, we very clearly have to follow the spiritual kingdom. It's not a thing of totally having totally separate boxes. That's not what I'm saying. At the same time, paying my taxes, driving the speed limit, wearing a safety harness in 100 degrees, finally is not a spiritual issue, is it? Unless I rebel, then it becomes a spiritual issue. Okay, going on. The third point, third responsibility I have as a Christian to the civil government is pray for them. Pray for them. It's been a couple years ago, but Hope, do you remember you and I had that conversation a number of years ago? About praying for them. I don't know, maybe that's what I should do. I haven't thought about praying for the Department of Revenue for a while. That'd be a good one. But 1 Timothy 2, verse 1 through 4 says this, I exhort therefore, that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men. So he starts on the level, everybody. So, okay. But then he goes on and gets specific. He says, for kings and for all that are in authority. Then he gives a reason that I find interesting, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. So we're supposed to pray for all men, for kings and all that in authority, that they could do their job in a way that blesses God's people. Nothing wrong with that. And in verse 4 then, he goes on, for this is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior, who will have all men to be saved and come unto the knowledge of truth. And again, I find it interesting, he says that he would have all men to be saved. Now, this brings up another thing is, as you talk to your neighbors, to people you work for, with, you again run into the thought is, but there were Christians who held government positions. I don't know what the ones I've heard brought up or that I've thought of myself was the Ethiopian eunuch, right? Says he was a treasurer or something for Candace, Queen of Ethiopia. You have Cornelius, a military man, actually. With a centurion would mean he would have had 100 soldiers under him, plus other servants likely. Definitely a converted man. You would have the keeper at the prison in Philippi become converted as keeper. Now, there's something interesting about the keeper of the prison at Philippi, if I can insert this here, is so this terrible earthquake comes. He's going to kill himself. Paul says, Paul and Silas say, oh, don't. We're all still all here. And it says, I just found the wording interesting. It says he brought them out of prison. He washed their stripes and was baptized. Now, if you're going to be in civil government, you're probably going to stress yourself out pretty seriously if you're going to go wash all the stripes that come your way. I'm not talking about beating people in our culture. But think about that. A jailer that actually took people out of jail probably was illegal to start with and then washed their stripes. So anyway, I'm not trying to build a big argument, but an interesting point. So to argue that because there were those in government position who were sincerely seeking truth, such as Cornelius, to argue that that now justifies the Christian to hold a position in government is a convolution nowhere supported in the practice of the church. Excuse me. Supported in the word or practices of the church in Scripture. You know, I'm going to go so far as to say that even today, it would definitely be possible, and I'd say that's even likely, that there are sincere seekers of truth who are part of a political party and our government policy and administration. I think there are sincere people sometimes involved in government today. But let me say this as well. Remember, the pursuit of truth, whether that's them, the sincere seekers of truth who may be part of a government, or whether it's me today, we're all on a journey of truth, right? We haven't arrived there yet. And so, just because that at this point in their journey, they do not have the understanding, they don't have the conviction that this is wrong for them, does that mean that I can turn around and say that's okay for me to do that? Absolutely not. Just because there may be a sincere Christian that today is serving in some political capacity in a representative form of government in this country, does in no way say that I, as a Christian, with the understanding I have, that I'm free to go run for that office. Consider further, what happens when a Christian becomes part of a program that uses force? And you can look at history. A really good one would be the Quakers in Pennsylvania. They were, Quakers are almost more pacifist, maybe, than non-resistance, at least today. I'm not saying they were. But, you know, William Penn was given that large tract of land that he could settle, and he bought it from the Indians, and he had some very good points. But finally, the Quakers ran a real snag even in being part of the legislature, and it led them actually away from non-resistance into pacifism. You know what happens is, as a Christian, so to speak, becomes part of a program that finds it necessary to use force, they will have to do one or two things, and both, either one is a compromise. The first is they will either have to support the questionable, be that a war, whatever it is, because they're part of this program, or they will find it necessary to take over that. They'll have to take control so that there's nothing unquestionable. But now, how can you really enforce laws against an evil person without force? You can't. So either way, you've created a problem that ends up with questionable results. You remember, God's kingdom is the spiritual kingdom built on the basis of love and choice. Okay, so bringing this back to some other things. Friction points. And I'm going to make these practical for myself. Likely, there's at least one or two of these. I doubt everybody will agree with me, and that's just fine. It's not that I can go to a verse in the Bible and say the Bible says exactly this or that, because it doesn't. But I would like for you to think about the consistency, and feel free to, voice your differences if we're not, try to be consistent in it. Okay, the first point, friction point I see is this thing of rights. Rights. That's a huge thing in this country. So we have the Bill of Rights, and all what the rights say is okay. So we have, I'm not going to name all 10, but we have the right to protest, the right to assemble, which is one reason we can gather this way. We have the right to trial by jury, which is why we get jury summons. We have the right to bear arms, to protect ourselves. I'd like for you to notice 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 2. Paul, talking to the Corinthians, says this. He says, "For I determined to not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified." So do you think Paul was a person that was obsessed with his rights? I find that hard to see in somebody that says that he's focused not to know anything save Jesus Christ and him crucified. That said, Paul, with the laws that the Romans had put into effect, wasn't scared, I should say, to necessarily make use of them where they helped him. But in that, I think he was always respectful. Remember, let's go back to Philippi, for example, there where he was beaten, where the jailer was converted. The next day, the people that had him beaten came and said, "Hey, you can leave now." And he said, "Well, y'all didn't follow your own law. Why don't y'all come, don't do this so quietly. You all come and take me now. I'm a Roman after." I don't know that he said that, but basically that was the gist of it. "I'm a Roman." He did tell him one other time there when he was arrested in Jerusalem and the centurion was going to have him beat to figure out what this fuss was about. I just asked, is it, can you beat a Roman without a trial? And the centurion was, "Whoa, no." So I don't know that it's wrong to do that in a respectful way. At the same time, I don't see Paul running around, "This is my right, that's my right," In fact, what's interesting to me is this emphasis, the earthly kingdom that we live in, so to speak, this earthly country, their emphasis on rights, I fear, has almost made us lazy Christians. And I'll say it this way. Their emphasis on rights has made it to where they're scared to kind of make me pay a price for having religious convictions against serving on the jury, right? So to be honest with you, if I would have had to spend the next 2 weeks on jury duty, it would have terribly messed up my schedule. It would have, because this thing came 3 weeks ago and I had at least some of my things fairly planned out already. And some things were not necessarily, for example, I got a meeting in Michigan that I'm secretary for and all that. So, that would just go. But finally, I think they would be totally legitimate to say, "Well, okay, so you got convictions against serving on the jury, that's fine. But I tell you what, for the judge to say you're going to sit here all the time that jury does, I actually wonder if it wouldn't be a good experience for me. I was trying to decide whether I should go do at least some of it just to show that I'm not playing hooky." It's not, finally, it's because somebody serves on a jury that, again, that there is some law and order that we appreciate. It's kind of made us lazy Christians. The other one that comes to mind, and I'm not trying to make a big statement on Social Security and all that, but you know what? One thing that's kind of funny to me is regardless how I or you or someone else feels about accepting Social Security, there would have been absolutely nothing wrong with a Christian paying it, at least, right? It's the taking of it where the question should be. So how come that one of the first forms some churches push at someone is this Social Security exemption form when they make a commitment? It looks a little bit weird, doesn't it? Because there's nothing wrong with paying it. Pay your taxes. If they give you an exemption, I don't think it's wrong to be Social Security exempt. Don't take me that way. But what I'm saying is, where's our focus? Is it really on a spiritual kingdom, or is it simply on kind of pretending that, I had my schedule planned, and so I just pull out this jury duty form, sign it off, and send it, and now I'm free to go do my thing. Where's my heart? In this thing, and that's the next friction point I have, is what about serving on a jury? Where am I on that? I had one brother, I forget it was before or after I got my letter, he was talking about it a little bit. And I'm not trying to run this brother down. There's a couple of you in that conversation, as I recall, may have been. He just asked the question, well, what's, you know, why don't we serve on the jury? You know, what's the big deal? That's a good question. It got me thinking. Let me reread some verses that I just read in Romans 13 there, verse 3 through 4. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good, but if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is a minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon them that do evil. So I would go so far as to say that the government has been given authority and responsibility for those things that are without the scope of the church and conscience. In those things without the church and the conscience, there is a necessary authority, an authority that must be for society to function. In this authority and responsibility, civil authority really has no choice but to use force to a degree, to back up its authority, because some people, you go to Proverbs, it says the fool doesn't understand anything else but a rod. There has to be force involved for those who do not obey out of conscience. Now think of what a jury person actually does, jury man or woman. They're asked to come, sit there, listen to the crime that occurred, listen to the evidence pinning the crime on this person, and then be read all the laws that pertain to this crime, and then they have to say whether this person is guilty or not guilty. Is either guilty or not guilty of this crime. That's their number one job. Then secondly, once the guilt or not guilty is chosen, if they're accused of being guilty, then the jury also recommends a punishment. Their job is to recommend a punishment or penalty for those who have broken, not followed the law. So let me ask you a question. How can a Christian who's to be focused on truth, how can a Christian whose focus is supposed to be on mercy and extending truth to others through mercy and forgiveness and a willingness to suffer wrong, how can he or she sit on a jury as a judge in that aspect and judge the transgressions of an earthly against earthly laws and advise punishment? For example, let me just give you an illustration. As I understand my paper and the questions it asks me for jury duty, evidently there is some dispute between a contractor and somebody he worked for. Now, that sounds like something I can associate with, okay? So if you buy a door from me and do not pay it, what does my Bible tell me to do as a Christian? Anybody tell me? Put a lien on your place? When you sell it, I get money before you do? Sue you? What am I supposed to do as a Christian? Forgive. Let it go. Let it go. Now, let's say that I go serve on that jury, and I sit there, and it sounds just exactly like things I've been through. You think the rest, I'm going to be much good as part of that system? If I say, well, I mean, contractor so-and-so, my Bible tells me I have to forgive. I think you should too. Is that enforcing the law? But how can I as a Christian do anything else? If I say, oh, well, I mean, yeah, I just forgive, but no, you have to pay. Where does the conflict of that whole thing come back on me? And that's, to me, is a fairly light case. Imagine you get into a murder case or something, it'd be that much worse. Because finally, a Christian's focus is on truth of the gospel, on mercy and forgiveness and bearing wrong. That is not the focus of the civil government in executing justice. It would never work. Yes, there might be elements of mercy. There's elements of truth, but it's not the truth and the mercy of God. So it would never work if you were trying to operate a civil government on a Christian basis. You would, quite frankly, have chaos from the very worst people. Okay, moving on. You know, it'd be contradictory and inconsistent to what it means to be a Christian, really, to take that place. If you need some verses to back that up, look at Matthew chapter 5, verse 21 through 26, 38 through 48, 1 Corinthians 6, 1 through 8. So what about voting was another friction point I have. What about voting? To be honest with you, you cannot go to the Bible anywhere and discover anything about voting. And Anabaptist people in general, their convictions on voting are weak enough that depending who runs and they get scared or excited enough, especially I think this happened in 1960. And again, I think it was 2008, some of that happened again on a fairly large scale. And again here when 2016. That they get themselves panicked enough, they'll go vote. That shows you the state of our convictions, I think. And I'm not saying that about anyone here. I'm talking in a broad case. But what about voting? Let me ask you a question. First of all, in the consistency aspect, would any of you think it was okay for me to go serve in the state legislature? Maybe I could get that far. I don't know. Or would any of you run to be a senator? U.S. House of Representatives, governor. You know, we would all say that those conflict with Christians, how is it different? Really, how is it much different to vote someone into an office than it is to run for an office? You're basically paying, asking someone else to go do that job. And then you're making a choice on top of it who's best for it. You know, it's all part of the same process, all part of the same kingdom, all part of the same system. You know, voting, in its essence, voting is the process whereby a representative, that means when you, 100 people select one person to stand up for them, voting is a process whereby a representative form of government chooses its policy and administration. So the next question is, how could a Christian with understanding, I'm talking with one that understands the two kingdom concept, participate in either forming and or funding the laws that benefit a state and an earthly country, or the enforcement and interpretation of the same laws? Because finally, when you're in that place, it's a little bit like would be for me to serve on a jury and to say, oh, you just need to forgive. How would it work if the legislature or the Senate, for example, was made up of true Christians? And I'm sorry, I'm not here in judgment, but what kind of weird body would that be? Would they pass? Would they be putting sanctions against Iran for developing nuclear weapons? I mean, you know, it would pose, it's just a total can of conflicts, actually, is what you open up when you get into that thing. The process of earthly government, again, inevitably conflicts with what it means to be a Christian. One who lives, one who works for, and one who's focused on an eternal country, a spiritual kingdom. Now, I'll tell you what happens is when we lose focus, when we're no longer working for that spiritual kingdom, but we're here being these cultural Mennonites, and we're playing this game of looking like we have convictions, but in reality, we're living for self. You know what? We find ourselves opening this door. Because it's really about self. And whenever it's about self, you will get involved in a representative form of government. But if it's about a different kingdom, a different focus, something different, I think that's the only way to stay different. And to me, that's a much better argument than simply non-resistance on its own. So taking this a step further, what about supporting a candidate? This is where it gets pretty tricky for me and some of the people I know. So sometimes this person that you've done a lot of business with, you think you know them well, they'll come and they say that they're running for mayor or whatever. And you know, I'm taking donations. Well, yeah, sure you are. Yeah, it feels pretty stupid not to just hand them a $10 bill. You feel, like you think you're tightwad or something after all. I mean, they might have spent thousands of dollars on you. And if they wanted a burger, if they had a hospital bill, if they needed gas, I would go way over and above for them. But when it comes to that political thing, I think I've got to tell them I'm an ambassador. What if, like sometimes happens when you know, well, wants to plant a yard sign in your yard? What are you going to do then? It's not easy to be a Christian. It's not always easy to be part of a different kingdom. Sometimes you look weird. You know, it's difficult, especially when you know and appreciate them on the personal level as an individual. But one thing I have found, at least for myself, is if they're willing to take the time to listen and I'm willing to take the time to explain how I view myself as an ambassador of the heavenly kingdom, we can still mutually respect each other. I have yet to, generally. That has worked actually quite well. So again, back to about supporting a candidate. I guess my personal views, how can I offer support, offer money? How can I give my word for, give account to those whose focus and whose emphasis is on an earthly process and country? Can I be consistent and support one in doing what I say I cannot do? Can I lend them my name, my recommendation, my commendation in their pursuit of position? Taking this a step further, and this is where probably I'm going to get disagreed with the most, and that's fine. Does everybody know what it means to be lobbying? A lobbyist? For those of you that don't, lobbying is a person who makes it their job to go tell the governor, to go tell the senators and all those people that make laws what laws are good for you and your business, right? So here a couple weeks ago, I had a call from a man I know very well and I appreciate a lot. He's a large businessman out of Jonesboro. And he happens to be head of Jonesboro Chamber of Commerce. And so he called me on his personal cell phone, mind you, not on a business phone, and asked basically as a personal favor if I would join the Chamber of Commerce. And of course this comes with its perks and things. Now I don't know, I need to take time, see if he can get time off his schedule to sit down and visit with me. I feel kind of bad, but I'd like for him to understand this. So I don't know what the Jonesboro Chamber of Commerce does. What I do know is what the U.S. Chamber of Commerce does. And that is, that's a large organization of many, many businesses that band together, and they all pay their $300, $400, $500 a year, whatever it is, to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's job, the reason for collecting these fees, basically, is to lobby the federal government to pass business-friendly laws and regulations. So now, can I voluntarily give $500 a year to an organization whose primary focus and reason for existing is basically to further what I want? Can I do that as a Christian? If it's simply a thing of telling them, yes, that may be one thing. Of suggesting, I'm okay with that. But if it's a thing of using pressure, of saying, over here we got two people running for office, and the one is business friendly and the one's not, so we shove a bunch of money at the one we like. Why not run for office yourself? Where's the consistency? And I'm trying to hit the business part. There is others. It's been a little while since I was strongly tempted on this. Back in my 20s, this was a real temptation for me. Does any of you know about the NRA, American Hunter magazine? That was probably the one I liked. And so the fee's not that high, and please understand me, I'm not trying to make sinners out of people if they necessarily have done this, but I would again ask you to consider the consistency of it. So I guess maybe you can give them their $30, whatever they want, and say that's the magazine subscription. But the reality is, most people in our culture, even if we don't know exactly what the National Rifle Association does, and that is that they're a pro-gun lobbying group big time. Now, I'm going to be frank with you. If the government passed a law that I had to lose all my guns, I don't have a collection. But I do have just enough that it would hurt, okay? And I'd kind of feel powerless against the raccoon with rabies if you took all my guns anyways. So I'd have good reasons, right? But there again, what does it say? Every ordinance of man. There's others I think sometimes we get innocently pulled into, maybe even more so than the NRA, is the World Wildlife Fund. You know, if you buy their calendars and stuff, and I'm again, if you get, I guess I let this personal, but They're getting money off of it that they're using for political purposes. Sierra Club would be another one that's pretty good at doing that backwards. Just listen again. The country and cause for which I have given my life and allegiance is not a country or cause of this world. If mine were an earthly country and cause, then would my disciples fight for my deliverance. But that is not the case. Mine is a spiritual kingdom. You say I am a king, and in this you are correct. I was born for and came to earth to bear witness to the truth. As king of truth, all who sincerely seek truth will hear my voice and become part of the same non-earthly cause and kingdom. Again, 1 Peter 2, verse 13 and 7 through 17. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme or unto governors as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do well. For so is the will of God, that with well-doing ye may be put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free and not using your liberty for a cloak of maliciousness, self, but as servants of God, honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. An ambassador for a spiritual kingdom of God, an ambassador for a heavenly country. Let's kneel for prayer.